Dive into Six Music on the BBC Sounds app and discover all our latest shows, sessions and mixes.
Six Music.
Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett, and you're listening to a brand new series of The First Time here on BBC Six Music and BBC Sounds. This is the show where you meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at the pivotal first musical moments that made them who they are today. Today's guest is a composer of music that encompasses both contemporary classical as well as contemporary electronic. But it's always music that's been created to inspire joy, to move you emotionally and physically, to surprise and delight you, and make you think and move. She's been responsible for creating some of the most memorable BBC proms in recent years. She's a Mercury Prize nominee. She's written incredible film scores. And she's worked with some of the finest orchestras around. And she's got a kick-ass live band. We've done Glastonbury and Latitude and shows all over the world. My guest on The First Time today is Anna Meredith. And you just heard Sawbones, taken from Anna's 2019 album, Fibs. In this show, we discuss Anna's formative musical loves and the devastating power that can only be delivered by a bunch of school kids playing the Skyboat song on amassed violins, and the music, both classical and 90s bangers, that shaped her life. We talk about her first groundbreaking BBC prom, the creation and huge impact of her famous track Nautilus, and why Björk, Josh Wink and Go West are just as important to her as Leos Janáček. But I started by asking Anna, as I do with all my guests, when was she first aware of music?
Well, there wasn't tons of music in my like family house. I don't ever really remember the radio or music really being on very much. And so I think the music that I did get hold of as a kid has really stuck with me. But I think one of the first memories I have is hearing Janopody, which is that bit of piano music that you might not think you know, but you probably do. That goes do 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 do. That's by Erik Satie. And yeah. I was bouncing on my bed to that. I think I had aspirational circus intentions at that point in my life. And yeah, I just remember seeing that tune and my parents coming in and saying, oh, how do you know that tune? But I think I remember that feeling like that's a banger.
Thank you.
kind of interesting that already, like, the rhythmical idea of physically bouncing up and down and music, even at that age, they're kind of linked already.
Yeah, I mean, it is true that physicality and music has gone on to be super, super important for me as I write. But yeah, I like music that makes me want to move in any capacity, bed, bounce, or whatever it's called.
So it wasn't a particularly musical household that you grew up in?
No, not at all. I mean, we'd have, you know, the classic, you know, the tapes that were in the car that were played over and over, you know, Graceland and some classical stuff and kind of those pieces, you know, we'd hear over and over and over. But I don't remember, you know, vinyls being put on and we wouldn't really go to concerts. So I kind of got my way into music more through learning to play instruments. Yeah. And bits of music, I guess you'd learn. And then as you got better at the instruments, you'd be learning, I suppose, more interesting bits of music. And then obviously, teenager, starting to hear what my friends were into and opening up that way.
Yeah, yeah. And fiddle was your first instrument, is that right?
Actually, it was probably recorder. The Wombles theme tune.
That's a banger. That was one of my first singles.
Isn't it so good? What a tune. I know. I've been writing a piece with recorders recently and I was trying to see if it was still there under the fingers. And yeah, I can still honk my way through the Wombles.
The muscle memory of the Wombles is still there.
It never leaves you.
Underground, overground, wombling free. The Wombles of Wimbledon, common are we. Making good use of the things that we find. Things of the everyday folks leave.
And but then it was a year, we had these Scottish fiddle lessons where, you know, lots of us would all saw our way through the Skyboat Song and, you know, that sort of stuff. So a bit of that. But clarinet became my main instrument from about 11 onwards.
Yeah. Skyboat Song, that is.
Oh, haunting, right?
I know.
Can't go wrong with it, especially for like beginner, you know, where you've got your sponge on your violin and the stickers. When you see a classroom of kids all staring with ferocious intensity at like tiny yellow stickers, trying to like gear themselves up to like, you know, not do the open strings, that's a kind of core memory. Yeah.
First singles you owned?
Okay. I was a real singles person. So like in the 90s, maybe I just didn't have enough money to buy albums, but I just bought millions of singles. So I remember on the same day I went and bought Elton John's The One and
nice.
Spiral Carpets Dragging Me Down. Which are two, you know, when I stand by those two benchmarks, I love The One. What a song. Oh,
yeah.
Get the candles out. And then, yeah, Dragging Me Down.
I wanna
I remember so clearly going to HMV in Edinburgh, getting the cassettes, you know, the ones that were like just crap cardboardy sleeves.
Yes, really awful quality.
Awful quality. And so expensive. Because I recently got my collection of all my singles. And as I say, I've got so many more singles than albums. And some of that, they're like $3.99 or $5.99 sometimes for a single. And you think, like, that's a lot of money, right, for a tune.
But then again, rather that than the devaluation of music, where we just assume that everything is essentially worth £10 a month.
That is,
disgust.
I mean, you make a good point. And that way I feel I contributed to the life of terrible indies and, you know, old crooners through my pocket money.
And the follow-up to that is the first album you owned.
It probably was something really unfun, like a Now compilation. I probably...
No, those are good. Those are good.
Oh, I mean, yeah, of course. I mean, no filler. Just wall-to-wall excellent tunes. I couldn't tell you the number, but it probably would have been... Because I didn't own a little hi-fi till I was sort of 14 or 15. And so I did a lot of taping the top 40 for my paper round on top.
Home taping is killing music.
I know, gods, I know, what a terrible. And trying to pause and, you know, the countdown, you know, when they didn't play the whole of the song, you know, you'd be there, absolutely devastating. So it probably was like Now, I don't know, let's say 19 and a half, that kind of era. And then after that, I got a whole bunch of, you know, it'd be like Nirvana, it'd be like Nevermind era. I probably would have got the Now compilation pre that.
Were you a proper It's Borrowed Carpet t-shirt, ripped cardigan, Doc Martin and leggings, proper indie kid?
So I was very like a kind of, what are my cool friends doing? So I was more I was in the grungy, long flowery skirts, Docs, long band t-shirt. You know, the ones where you'd have a logo in the front that was so plasticky and heavy that you felt like you were wearing armour, like some enormous Pearl Jam thing. Or like some more Red Hot Chili Peppers or whatever, some logo that was just like made you entirely rigid from plastic. So yeah, I'd be wearing that on my Bjork t-shirts, long droopy hair, probably some kind of cardigan, you know, various colours of Docs. I had these amazing bright blue Docs and floor length flurry skirt indie kid.
All cool again now, 90s.
Finally, it's got hang in there.
When I was doing a bit of research for this, I was trying to find out a bit more about the first piece of music that you wrote, even at school, whatever. And I found a quote where you said, I think my GCSE piece was the first work that was noticed, perhaps because it included instructions to headbutt the keyboard or play with the nose as well as the hands. Is that true?
Yeah, that is true. I didn't write any music. It didn't even occur to me that you could write music. But yeah, I wrote a piece for, you know how on those keyboards you have it in the classroom, how you can do single finger chords, you know, down the bottom, the left-hand side. And that always makes it feel so much better because you're, you know, you don't have to be doing anything fancy. You can just make the stuff that sounds amazing. So I think I wrote it for, it was probably like Bossa Nova 3, you know, one of those sort of rhythms. Yeah. But yeah, you had to change the sounds through the piece. And the only way I could think to change sounds because you're still playing was to do this through a sort of gentle, graceful dive onto the, you know, organ 2 preset. So that was that. And then the second piece, I remember this as well, I was trying to be a bit more serious, was for Flute and Left Hand of Piano, which I thought was a beautiful title. I was going to call it Reflections, but I spelt it wrong. And so Relflections goes down as like an unfortunate typos. Well, not even typos, handwritten, just dyslexia, I don't know, kicking in.
I quite like that as a title, though.
Relflections, yeah, I like it.
It's actually quite good.
Quite a bit less pretentious, right?
Yeah. What was the first live music concert you went to, the first gig or concert you can remember, or the one that made an impact on you?
Well, this makes me sound so much cooler than I was or am or ever could be. But the first gig I went to was the Velvet Underground.
Oh, what?
I know, but let me just caveat it with so many things that I had never heard of the Velvet Underground. And my friend Lucy's older brothers were into it. And we'd never been to any gigs. I was probably 14. And she was like, oh, apparently there's this cool band called the Velvet Underground who are coming to Edinburgh. Do you want to go to this gig? At this point, I didn't even own any music. So I think the only thing I managed to do was listen to Sunday Morning once before we got to... And I was like, oh, that's nice, lovely, kind of cute little stuff. But I didn't hear anything else. And it meant that when I went to the gig and, you know, we couldn't have been cooler there with our Docs on and, you know, all our various floral numbers. But it meant that, having never been to a gig, that when the support were on, I thought the support were Velvet Underground. And I just couldn't understand I was sitting there going like, well, that was a great tune. God, this band are good. And thinking, what, everyone else is so much cooler than me that they're so cool that they don't even want to hear Velvet Underground. They're all in the bar. So yeah. And then I was like, after they finished, I was like, well, that was great. Let's go home. And then it clocked to me that actually they were not Velvet Underground. I don't even know who they were actually. Yeah. So, you know, a bit of gig etiquette and not knowing any of the tunes, which of course now I do know, but I can't claim to have had any real intention of seeing a Velvet Underground. Circumstance led me there.
Dawning. It's just a restless feeling by my side. Early dawning, Sunday morning. It's just the wasted years so close behind. Watch out, the world's behind you. There's always someone around you who will call. It's nothing at all. Sunday morning, and I'm falling. I've got a feeling nothing at all.
Even there, like the jumping on the bed, you are having a formative experience with a band who blended organic instrumentation with the avant-garde, and it's all feeding into maybe not, maybe I'm just
assuming. No, thank you.
Like,
I
it's would going
love
in.
Yes, that it is all going in, I guess, but probably at that point I was way more thinking about, does this make me look cool to be at the Velvet Underground, or am I being an acceptable teenager, than is this music any good? And I guess by that point I learn about the idea of a support act. You know, these are important things to figure out at some point in your life. But and it always makes me, just makes me sound cool, even though I really, really know I was not, and still I'm not. Yeah.
When you started studying music seriously, who were the kind of people that you really admired and you really looked up to, or you really, I'm being drawn towards this, this way of approaching composition?
I probably felt like I kept things split into two areas, which is something I've tried not to do anymore. But I mean, I suppose on one hand, you could say it was like classical and pop, but it probably wasn't as divided as that. It would probably be the music that I felt I was studying and composers I admired, or music that I thought was interesting or thought-provoking, and then stuff that was just pure joy. And, you know, I wasn't thinking about what am I learning from this music or what can I dig into. I was just, I don't know, dancing around to it. So I've always loved Björk. You know, when I first got into her in the mid-90s, I've listened to her albums obsessively. And, you know, I've got lots of dusty old, you know, the debut cassettes, and been to see her millions of times. So she's always been there, and she probably is right in the middle of all that stuff. You know,
yeah,
she's always,
absolutely.
Always interesting, but also writes music that's just, you can listen to on repeat, and it's joyful and it's visceral and it's all that good stuff.
We live on a mountain, right
Stuff that was just silly and fun, whether that be some big orchestral massive sound, because by this point I would be playing in little youth orchestras, and that's a really amazing way to experience music, is to be in an orchestra. I play clarinet, which means you're kind of right in the middle of the orchestra, people behind you, people either side, people in front, and you're right in the middle of the sound. And I love that, and that was a brilliant way to experience music. So these big symphonies, you know, Tchaikovsky's and Shostakovich's and all that sort of stuff. I love all that. But then I guess I'd also be learning about living composers and people who were writing interesting music. Louis Andriessen, I've always really loved, or a Scottish composer like James McMillan. And these were people who I had no idea about probably at that point, but was starting to, once I kind of got in my head that people were writing, it was crazy, because I think all through school, I thought that composers, it was more like learning about history. You were learning about dead people and the way that they wrote music in the 18th, 19th, 20th century, whatever. But the idea that people were still...
It's happening now.
Never occurred to me. So that one clicked a little bit later. So yeah, I think a bit of a mixture of stuff to study and be interested in and stuff for joy was kept quite separate at that point.
At the Royal College of Music, you may have mentioned this before about this idea of feeling some imposter syndrome. For me, I actually think it's the most normal and healthy thing in the world to feel that. Because I think anyone that's got absolute 100% confidence in everything they do is a sociopath. Because if you think that everything you do is amazing, you deserve to be everywhere you are, then you've probably got issues. But was that a real feeling, that you maybe didn't belong in the hallowed halls of this place?
Totally. I mean, and it seems crazy now, because I now really totally don't feel it matters even slightly. But at the time felt, you know, I'd only come to composing quite late. I mean, as I say, this is in a very now ridiculous time frame. But I, you know, some of my friends had been writing little pieces since they were tiny little kids. And I'd only started in my exams, as I say, in my sort of 15, 16. And
oh, so old, 15, 16.
Exactly, past it, you know, no chance. Really? I know, ridiculous. And yeah, you know, it's true that some of those pieces were, well, all over the place, sort of, you know, trying to figure out, I suppose, my voice and trying to please teachers and get good marks and all that stuff that felt like it mattered. So, yeah, absolutely. I felt definitely not as well you know, I didn't know the names and the dates, and the music wasn't super sophisticated. And I think I was even probably told by some teachers that I was, you know, a bit of an afterthought of an admission, you know.
No, what?
Well, yeah, I know it was a bit unfortunate that, but you know, I showed them, etc. And it is a strange environment. These, you know, I think they have changed a lot, but those music conservatoire colleges, because they're very serious, and you know, you're there for one intention, and it's to, you know, excel at whatever thing you're doing, playing an instrument, whatever. And the way that I've always wanted to approach stuff is with a little bit of irreverence, and that was what also kind of added to that feeling, as it felt like if you didn't approach writing in a particular way, in a particular quite academic way, that it wasn't valid. So yeah, it took me a long time to sort of figure that stuff out, I guess.
But then you've got this situation where I think, or it appears from the outside, not about not taking it seriously, but taking the rules less seriously, are the very things that start to get you noticed. And the very things that start to basically, well, why can't I put that and that together? Why can't I approach it like that? Are the very things that mean that maybe some of the public that wouldn't find your stuff as easily are finding roots into it, because it feels quite inclusive, because it's not as rigid. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, thanks. I mean, that's how I feel about it, is I, you know, I take writing really seriously. I work my arse off, and I'm really rigorous in how I write, but I want the music to feel physical and euphoric. It's not designed to be pretentious. I want people to come with me.
There's no distance between the audience.
Right, exactly. And, you know, so sometimes I get, you know, people be like, oh, you've had all this, it's written out with the head, and there's no, maybe they look at the background and they think they're not going to like it. And of course, lots of people aren't going to like it. But the way that it's written, it's not like that. I write it to be inclusive and, you know, let's all go on the journey of this track and the where it's going to go to, and the twists and turns or the changes, you know, I hope it does feel open. And it's and I guess I use myself as a kind of barometer. I'm seeing, does this feel satisfying or surprising? If I do this suddenly at this moment, does it fulfill a seed that I've planted earlier on in the track, or does it suddenly, do I pull a trapdoor out from under you and you're in a new place? And but it's all designed for anybody who's up for coming along for the ride to come with you. And and so yeah, in a way, I think some of that training, it's helped me have the tools to be able to write like that, but I've tried to shake off any of the ideas of where that music should be played or what it should be written for or how you should listen to it, any of that kind of stuff, which really doesn't matter at all.
I want to talk about Leos Janacek, because that's a name that you've referenced as being not a blueprint, but like, okay, there can be the dynamism, there can be scale without being pompous, I guess. Is that right?
Yeah, Janacek's amazing. It's like beautiful, huge, you know, I always love things that are scaled up. I love things that are massive, whether things that are loud, things that are technicolor. The bigger the better for lots of aspects of, you know, music for me, or art in lots of ways. Or, you know, or tellies, you know, I don't know. I like for things to punch through. If I'm doing a gig, to get someone not looking at their phone and to be there because everything is just so dialed up to 11.
Yeah, totally.
And Janacek kind of does that. You know, pieces have loads of extra brass instruments or extra percussion, or they're just theatrical but direct and beautiful tunes. Sinfonietta, if you haven't heard that piece, is a big orchestral piece with all these extra brass at the beginning, which is just so awesome. And I think that felt like a kind of, okay, this is how things can feel.
We're going to change musical tack a little bit, because I was doing my research into music that's influenced you, and Go West, We Close Our Eyes.
Oh, what a song.
Was kind of an unexpected, I mean, I must admit, I don't believe in guilty pleasures. I just believe in tunes. I'm sorry. Great tunes are just great tunes.
This is the thing. It's this kind of other side to me that I've always loved, like 80s, 90s dance anthem stuff. anything that is joyful and over the top. So for a while, I taught a youth orchestra where I would teach the composers who were attached to this orchestra. And I'm not a very good teacher, but the thing that I would contribute, and I would do this course with someone who was a very good teacher, so they'd kind of do all the teaching content. But the thing that I would do is basically build these insanely elaborate obstacle courses, so over the top, for these composers, and I'd make them stand outside and sign a waiver or be like, for their lives and stuff, you know, like no responsibility taken. And they come in one at a time to this room where I'd set up all the equipment, and they'd have to like bomb around this thing where I'd make them do some kind of nerdy music things, like quickly bind a score, and they'd be like quickly binding a score, and then they'd have to like scrabble through lots of boxes, and then I'd duck for an apple and then sprint down a corridor, and I'd be like chucking stuff at them and blasting Go West at insane volumes, and these poor kids are like sort of shaking with like nerves and adrenaline. But yeah, anything that's just sort of gets the juices flowing, that's what you want, right?
Sees the release of Black Prince Fury, your first EP, your first kind of thing under your own name as a release of you. And it's got Nautilus on it, which is, it's your Bohemian Rhapsody, it's your Freebird, it's your Radiohead's No Surprises. It's
the chromatic scale gift that keeps on giving.
Indeed, it's really fascinating to see when a song connects in a way that you normally wouldn't expect a song. I mean, obviously, here on Six Music, we love your stuff, and I believe we got right behind that tune because we loved it, and obviously the kind of classical world loved it as well. And then you see it sort of transferring onto film soundtracks, adverts and things, and it's kind of moves into this place.
Yeah.
That must have been amazing for this, yeah, this sort of odd, undulating, Shepard-Tony kind of piece to start living in people's heads that you never thought maybe it would end up there.
You know, and that was written right at the very beginning, when I was just starting to experiment with writing electronics, which was something I was doing purely for me, you know, unlike all the other music I was writing, they were commissions, which mean, you know, so someone's asking for them, and maybe there's a bit of money and there's deadlines. So this stuff is, nobody's asking for it. There's no players. It's just me figuring out, yeah, nobody wants it. I mean, it's true. I sent that EP, Black Prince Fury, to loads of record labels, and, you know, and it was, again, designed very physically. I wrote it. I remember I was striding along this beach, Bamborough, up in the northeast on like a family holiday. And I think I had that like the rising thing. And then I noticed that my legs, I was walking at a different speed to a singing. And I thought, oh, but brilliant. What's this? You can hear this idea in two different ways. So that was a kind of, but it was nice that it happened so naturally. It was sort of my body was giving me a clue as how to use this material. So yeah, and it's been brilliant to see it. Oh, and crazy to see where it's been used all over the place.
We'll be right back.
a while I was quite sort of protective about it, kind of, you know, oh, it must only be the full track or nothing. And now, I don't know, I guess just chuffed and honoured that anybody wants to use it at all. And, you know, people do arrangements of it or play sort of vaguely similar-ish versions of it. And there's been these big marching bands in America have done this huge version with like massive extra runs and amazing choreography, and there's, you know, uses and adds. So it gets around, and also thankfully still love it, still play it every gig with my band. And yeah, it's the journey of it, you know, it starts and you just settle into it, and it's always powerful and you feel powerful when you're playing it, which is an amazing feeling. Actually, it's brilliant. That is a great thing when music makes you, you know, you can be feeling a bit down on power or confidence, and the way I can feel by the end of listening to or playing that track versus the beginning is such a gift that I've kind of given myself, I guess.
I read as well that when it comes to when you first approach a composition, it's done quite sort of physically, in terms of there's like a big piece of paper and then you start plotting it out visually using shapes. And writers do that a lot. I know that if you're putting together like a play or a screenplay, then you often plot out the movement and the story beats. But I haven't heard of a composer starting off with the visual side.
Not very, very beginning, but I had a really important composition lesson where I had a piece due the next day and hadn't written anything, and I was really panicking, and my teacher was understandably getting totally fed up with me. And he said, oh, for God's sake, just sing me the piece. And I was like, oh, what do you mean? Sing it? Anyway, so just sing me the piece. And so I was like, okay, well, maybe it's this, blah, blah, blah. And as I was singing, he was kind of drawing these shapes, like, you know, big triangle building things, or something's kind of built winding down or whatever. And then he just handed me this bit of paper and said, see, you know, here's your piece. And having that map was like a total light bulb. And it just helps me, well, helps me in so many ways. The thing I really pride myself on is pacing, and is having this feeling of where are you heading to. Quite often I work backwards. I work from like, what is the end of the piece, or what is the peak, what's the climactic moment of the piece, or what am I trying to earn in the music? How do I make this moment a surprise, or how do I make this how do I make this payoff work? So you work from the payoff to sow the seeds for it going backwards.
Okay.
On the most basic level, if you want something really sound loud and shocking, you do it by being quiet, 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 surprise. You know, so you work out how you want this moment near the end or wherever it is to feel, and then you set it up, whether that's a sort of organic build into it or whether it's a twists and turns that make it feel surprising because it's so unlike what's gone before. So, and I feel like it's something we all do all the time anyway. If we're telling a story to our mates and you've got a punchline, and then this, you set it up, you know, we all set up the kind of, oh, it's just a normal day and I was doing whatever. And that storytelling idea of setting up a reveal or a moment or a punchline makes sense in, as you're saying, in written work. And I do it as well now when I'm doing film soundtracks. I'll use the same, you know, I'll draw the shape in from the film. The film will tell me what the shape and the stuff is. So it just helps me to keep control of the experience in 5 minutes. How do I want that 5 minutes to feel? And sitting for 5 minutes and listening to what 5 minutes actually feels like, and where something would feel like a shock. And actually, could you then tighten that screw a little bit further and agonize that release a little bit longer so that it's not quite where you think it's going to be, but a bit further? So using time to tell me what the music needs to do is really important, and then drawing that out.
Which does bring me on to my next question. What was the first film score that you worked on? It was eighth grade, was it?
It was eighth grade, yeah, which was such a gift of a first score. All my career up to there has been, I'm the one going, here's your masterpiece, enjoy. You know, like, you know, I'm deciding when it's done. And, you know, if you rewrite a commission, orchestral piece or whatever, and you hand it over, nobody is ever saying, the only thing they probably care about is the duration. Is that, is it long enough? Okay. And then apart from that, it's just like, great, well done. So it's very humbling to suddenly be told, not quite. And I really had to fight to be okay with that, because that's just how this business works. But I know that I'm not somebody who's very good at sounding like anyone else. I prefer not to have a film where they want a score that sounds like another score. So,
which happens a lot, I would imagine.
It happens a lot. So I'm trying to always upfront talk to directors, you know, who are interested in what I can do, one way or another. And it's not going to be for everybody, but eighth grade in a way was a total gift, because I went into it not knowing a lot of that, just being like, okay, well, the music's obviously going to be a huge part of this film. And thank God it was, but I wrote it all with, again, with just complete assumptions about this is the right piece for this, this is the right stuff for this, and the music is massive in that film. You know, it's like so loud, and I'm so grateful to Bo Burnham for letting me do that, because I guess it's, for better or worse, it's given me like a sort of belief that it is possible to, you know, have the music really be a big driver in the film. I like it as a balance, like the balance of, I've got my band stuff or my album stuff or my other projects, which are all me and all my stuff, and I'm driving them and I'm making them happen and they're my ideas. And that's amazing. And I have complete control, but it's also a lot of responsibility and pressure and money. And to have something in balance to that, where we're all working in service of something bigger, the film. We're all just trying to make this film work. And I quite like to flip between those two. And sure, when you're doing one, you're like, oh my God, I can't wait to do my own thing again, or God, I can't wait to do something where it's just not all on me. So I'm like a sort of fickle nightmare. But it's an interesting, and I've found quite humbling, and in some ways quite beneficial thing to help you kind of let go a bit and be like, okay, I think this tune is amazing, but you don't, so that's fine. She says through gritted teeth.
The live band.
Yeah.
You, Maddie, Jack and Sam, it's become a real huge part of how people experience you and what people, how people think about you and your music. And I think, you know, obviously we've got to give people credit for being pretty broad-minded, but I think sometimes maybe people have seen you at Glastonbury or Latitude or something like that, that maybe are less familiar with going to concert halls, maybe.
Right.
I'm generalising quite a bit. Can you remember the first shows you did as a group, as a rock band, and how you were like, okay, this is an ongoing thing now. This feels so good. It's got to be like not just a one-off. Tell me about those first shows.
Yeah. As a band, what would we have done? I think we did some quite small London gigs, you know, sort of little London venues, 200 capacity, you know, sweaty, intense things. And because I'd bought in these players who are mates, and it's been a kind of evolving thing to work with them, but who individually are incredible players. And I guess leaning on their virtuosity a bit and the spectacle of how brilliant they are, and but also how well we all get on. And so it's probably one of those gigs just where it was, you know, tiny and sweaty and intense, but everyone was losing their minds and feeling like the sort of music is intense and sweat is like dripping off the walls, little venues, and the speakers are shaking and the whole room feels like it's going to implode. And, you know, we are drenched in our sweats, but we're all wearing our costumes. And it's like, you know, I think there would have been a thinking of, okay, this really
more of this, please.
More of this, yeah. And it's exhausting, but like you're absolutely wired from the adrenaline of it. And, you know, then we've, you know, worked in it and honed it and, you know, tweaked it from there. But it's you know, we've been playing together in one form or another for nearly 10 years now, and I love playing with those people. It's so euphoric, and it's an amazing way to like bring that music, the live version of it, the release, and watching people come with you on the journey of some of those tracks is just a total privilege and such fun.
Moving on stylistically again, you talked earlier about your kind of love of dirty 90s electronic music. Josh Winks, Higher States of Consciousness.
What a banger.
Possibly one of the bangers of all bangers.
Yeah, the bangeriest banger.
It's a bit like Blue Monday, isn't it? It's like, if anyone plays that in the club, everyone's on it. It's inescapable. When did you first hear or experience that?
I mean, it must have been some like drunken night out. And what I love about that, talking about that pacing thing, is it just, it does exactly that. You know, it just doesn't, the beat doesn't come in till way past when you think it's gonna, you know, it's like, you know, it's like filtering and filtering for forever. And you're like, it's so agonizing, but it's so binary as well. You know, that's what the whole track is just doing, is just doing one big, inevitable, inexorable build-up. And I do remember probably getting my hand on the single and buying it. And my parents were having a dinner party and I came home and I was really drunk. I made my parents and their friends sit and listen to this track. Like, you've got to hear this. So they're all sitting there eating their whatever. And I made them sit through a probably like extended mix six, you know, like 7 minute, you know, Josh.
No, Mum and Dad, this is brilliant. Wait, listen.
On it goes, but yeah, what tune, love it. Yeah, I still listen to it quite a lot.
Did you react when you first heard you were going to be a member of the British Empire?
Fairly surreal, right? I mean, not right. Something I set out to look for. And yeah, you know, I think just sort of leaning into the bonkersness of that whole situation.
Who did you get it from?
I got Wills. And we actually had some pretty good banter.
I've heard that about him in these situations. Go on, tell me.
Well, it's like Devil with Prada. So like you're queuing up and he's got a minion behind him who like leans over and like says, this is Anna. She's a composer. You know, like it gives him a little 10-second pre-see. So he's like, ooh, I hear you're a composer. And I can't remember what we chatted about. They were playing some music and I told him it wasn't very good. And and then I told him about how I was such a loser at school and how I was really crap and how, you know, I had to hide away from all the cool kids in the school music room because I wasn't cool enough to hang out with them. And then at some point he's like, and look at you now. And that was my cue. I got mine at the same time as MIA, which is probably actually in some ways even more exciting because she's obviously so glamorous and cool and amazing. So I just hung around with her all day going like, oh, you're amazing.
What's next? What's happening at the moment?
I have been writing a new album, well, a new band album. I mean, I've been doing lots of other stuff, but for the last 4 years, I've been making this thing. And it's nearly...
That's a long time.
It's really long time. I mean, I've been doing some other stuff, but I've been doing just that for a year to get it over the line. And it's very nearly done. So, you know, it's been a huge thing, again, just to sort of carve time out of anything that makes money and to choose to go back into this band world again, you know, because Fibs, the last album was in 2019, so it's been a while. Mm-hmm. I pushed myself and see what I could do with this writing, and I think it's darker and dancier and the tunes are wilder and longer and weirder, and you know, everything feels more extreme. Everything's pushed a bit, so that's nearly over the line. So people always seem to be stunned at how long it takes from finishing a record when it comes out, but it's finishing touches and then need to get a plan in place. But I'm hoping next year that'll come out.
And the last question, what's the final song that we should play? It can be anything. It can be something you heard this morning or something you've loved your whole life.
Okay, I think we should play Guns N' Roses' November Rain. Just because it's such a journey. And well, I had it on my paper round. So I had it on this tape that I listened to in this pouring rain. I'd do this paper round and I had this one top 40 where they put the whole of that track, and it is very long. So you're totally forgiven for not playing it. But if you're not going to not play it, you have to play the second half.
Okay, sure.
Sometimes they just miss the good bit with the like big guitar solo, which is what it's all building up to. And you're like, what are you doing? You give me my solo. And it's just so unapologetically the drama, the theatricality, the daftness, the wailing guitars, the like crooning, the different sections. It's your Bohemian Rhapsody, it's your Paranoid Android, but done in ridiculous, cheesy metal context. Why not? What's not to love?
I do think we've lost something by being too clever and too ironic, and this idea that authenticity is to be valued more than anything. And it's like sometimes stand on a cliff edge, like with a guitar that's not even plugged in, with a helicopter behind
yeah.
you in leather pants with those laces up the side.
Rowing.
Sometimes that you is just... It's just as brilliant as someone
just like
writing...
throwing rose petals yeah. into a gale, maybe yeah. like diving onto a coffin. Yeah,
that's just as good.
I don't want anyone's like sort of things about their personal hopes and feelings. I want outward projected melodrama and theatricality yeah. all the way, please.
That was, obviously, Guns N' Roses with November Rain. Not the start of the song, but from where Slash's guitar solo kicks in, as very specifically requested by Anna Meredith, my guest on today's episode of The First Time. And thank you to Anna for being on the show. And that's the end of this show. I'll be back tomorrow with another brand new episode of The First Time, where my guest will be none other than frontman from The National, Matt Berninger. And of course, you can listen back to previous First Time shows from this season on BBC Sounds, which include my chats with Jim Moyer, also known as Vic Reeves, Ezra Furman, John Fogerty from Creedence Clearwater Revival, Skin from Skunk Anansie, and Billy Idol. Oh yes. Until next time, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.